Welcome to the Anesthesiology Journal podcast, an audio interview of study authors and editorialists.
Hello, I'm Jim Rathmel, professor of anesthesia at Harvard Medical School and chair of the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative and Pain Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital. I'm one of the executive editors for Anesthesiology, and you're listening to an anesthesiology podcast that we've designed for physicians and scientists interested in the research that appears in the journal. Today, we're going to talk with the authors of an original research article and the author of an accompanying editorial that appear in the July 2021 issue. With us today are Drs. Larry Glantz and Andre Lacerna. Dr. Glantz is professor in the Department of Anesthesiology, Perioperative Medicine, and the Department of Public Health Sciences at the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York. Dr. Lacerna, who's the first author, is a CA1 resident in anesthesiology at the University of Rochester. Dr. Glantz is the senior author on the article, and Dr. Lacerna the first author, and it appears in the July 2020 issue of the journal. It's titled Levels of Evidence Supporting the North American and European Perioperative Care Guidelines for Anesthesiologists Between 2010 and 2020, a systematic review. Drs. Glantz and Lacerna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. Rathmel, for giving Dr. Lacerna and I the opportunity to discuss our paper. We look forward to discussing our work with you and Dr. Newman for this podcast for the anesthesiology readership.
Thank you, Dr. Rathmel. Very happy to be here as well.
We also have with us today Dr. Mark Newman. Dr. Newman is the Horatio C. Wood Associate Professor of Anesthesiology and a senior fellow in the Leonard Davis Institute of Health Economics, as well as co-director of the Penn Center for Perioperative Outcomes Research and Transformation at the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Together with Dr. Jeff Affelbaum from the University of Chicago, Dr. Newman authored an editorial that accompanies Dr. Glantz's original research article in the July 2021 issue of the journal, and it's titled Clinical Practice Guidelines in Anesthesiology, Adjusting Our Expectations. Dr. Newman, welcome and thank you for joining us.
Thanks so much, Dr. Rathmel. It's great to be here.
Drs. Glantz and Lacerna, congratulations on the publication of your study. Now, you set out to examine the quality of evidence supporting published recommendations and clinical guidelines for anesthesiologists, and there are thousands of published recommendations in various anesthesiology clinical practice guidelines. What was your original hypothesis when you started this enormous undertaking?
So our original hypothesis was that most recommendations and clinical practice guidelines are supported by a low level of evidence. By way of background, we believe that reducing preventable deaths and complications after surgery requires a better understanding of the gaps in the evidence base used by anesthesiologists to make clinical decisions. In particular, anesthesiologists rely on clinical practice guidelines published by leading societies because these recommendations are intended to represent best practices. However, clinical practice guidelines are only valid if the scientific basis for these guidelines is valid. So our goal in the study was to better understand the evidence base for anesthesia clinical practice guidelines.
Dr. Lacerna, a few questions for you. This is a systematic review of those guidelines. Tell us how you identified clinical practice guidelines for review and describe the systematic methods you applied when you reviewed each recommendation.
So to answer your question, I want to start by saying that we followed the Cochrane methodology and the PRISMA statement for the development of this systematic review. We started by developing a sensitive and specific search strategy that included the North American and European anesthesiology societies, the major North American and European societies, and the names of the leading subspecialty societies, followed by the 10 anesthesiology journals with the highest impact factors, and terms related with the clinical practice guidelines and synonyms. So we searched Medline and Embase with the time filter between January 1st, 2010 and September 9, 2020. And we also searched the web pages of the included societies. After all these, we identified 7,808 references that we further screened by title and abstract. We included all documents with a clear statement of being a clinical practice guideline and that graded the level of evidence of their recommendations. It is important to say that we excluded guidelines related to critical care medicine and chronic pain medicine. So our initial screening and the full text evaluation were performed independently by two investigators, and the disagreement between them were resolved by consensus. The final analytic cohort consisted of 60 clinical practice guidelines with 2,280 recommendations. So what did we do with these recommendations? We classified the recommendations using the American College of Cardiology, American Heart Association, or grade classification system. For those guidelines that did not explicitly classify the level of evidence using the ACCHA or the grade systems, two investigators independently classified the recommendation using the grading system that most closely approximated the grading system used in the guideline. So, for example, the ASA guidelines use a system similar to the ACCHA, so that's the one we use for them. We further subdivided the recommendations according to their strength, so strong or weak, and by anesthesia specialty as well.
So what did you learn?
Well, thanks for that question, Dr. Rathnell. Our main finding is that half of all recommendations were supported by low level of evidence. And when we looked only at strong recommendations, those where the benefit clearly outweighed the risk or vice versa, we also found that low level of evidence support half of strong recommendations. And if you think about it, in theory, these are the recommendations that would be expected to have the highest quality of evidence to support them. The other thing we did was that we examined the quality of evidence supporting the clinical practice guidelines across different subspecialties. And we found that the quality of evidence varied also by specialty. In particular, the proportion of low level of evidence was about 70% for obstetrics, acute pain and regional, and 80% for neuroanesthesia, compared to 50% for recommendations for non-specialty care. So finally, we asked the question, did the quality of evidence improve over time? And we answered this question by comparing the recommendations in revised guidelines to the recommendations in the original guideline. And we found that the recommendations in the revised guidelines were not more likely to be associated with higher quality of evidence compared to the recommendations in the original guidelines. So briefly to summarize, we have three main findings. The first, low level of evidence support half of all recommendations, including strong recommendations. Second, the recommendations for some of the anesthesia subspecialties are supported by lower level of evidence compared to others. And then third, the quality of evidence has not changed significantly over time. So I think those are the three take-home messages of our study.
Dr. Glantz, back to you. Now, I just want to repeat what Dr. Lucerna just told us. So half of the recommendations in anesthesiology clinical practice guidelines are based on a low level of evidence, and things didn't change over time. They're not improving. How do you think we, as a specialty, should go about improving the existing clinical guidelines or creating new guidelines going forward?
Before I answer it, I think it's important to put our findings into context. So there was a landmark study that was published in JAMA back in 2009, which examined the scientific evidence underlying the ACCHA clinical practice guidelines. And in that study, what they found was that 48% of the recommendations were supported by low level of evidence. That's really similar to what we found. And then also by way of background, in 2020, anesthesia departments received about $210 million in funding, whereas internal medicine departments received $5 billion in NIH funding. Yet, despite this very large gap in public funding, when you compare anesthesiology to internal medicine and cardiology, the evidence gap between cardiology clinical practice guidelines, and that was published in that JAMA paper, and anesthesia clinical practice guidelines is really not all that large. So to answer your question, I think that the key to improving existing clinical practice guidelines is to increase the amount and quality of scientific research in anesthesiology. The need to improve research in anesthesiology was recently addressed in a white paper describing the creation of the Anesthesia Research Council, which grew out of a summit of leaders from the ASA, AUA, FAIR, and IARS. So Mark Newman is a co-author in this white paper, along with Jim Eisenach, Deb Cully, Colleen Cook, and others. And that summit led to the creation of the Anesthesia Research Council, with a mission to promote the development and dissemination of research in anesthesiology, perioperative, and pain medicine. And this group noted several major barriers to anesthesiology research. Number one, inadequate funding. And number two, insufficient institutional support. And these are caused, they believed, in part by the lack of the recognition of the contribution of anesthesiologists to health outcomes. So I think as a specialty, we can best improve existing clinical guidelines by advancing the science of anesthesiology, which means asking the right questions, better supporting the research efforts of anesthesiology clinical scientists, and working even harder to develop the next generation of anesthesiology physician researchers.
What were the limitations of your study?
So our study had several limitations. First, our study looked at the scientific basis for recommendations and clinical practice guidelines developed by major anesthesiology societies in North America and Europe, and should not be generalized to include all of the evidence base for anesthesiology and perioperative medicine. Second, there is no uniform grading system for assigning levels of evidence. So, for example, the ACC-HA classification system classifies recommendations as low level of evidence if they are based on expert opinion or case studies. RAID, on the other hand, classifies evidence from some observational studies or randomized controlled trials with serious flaws as low level of evidence. However, despite using two different grading systems, we still found that most guidelines were based on low levels of evidence. Third limitation is that for the guidelines that were similar but not identical to either the ACC/AHA grading system or the GRADE system, we map their grading systems to either the ACC/AHA systems or GRADE. Then fourth, the ACC/AHA definitions for level of evidence has changed slightly over time. We used the older version of that grading system presented in that seminal JAMA paper because this version of the ACC-AHA grading system was more closely approximated to the approach used by the ASA and other anesthesiology clinical practice guidelines.
So how would you advise practicing anesthesiologists to apply the existing guidelines today in light of your findings?
So I would advise clinicians to continue to rely on clinical practice guidelines as a trusted source of best practices. In theory, we as individual clinicians should all make our best efforts to understand the scientific basis of the practice of anesthesiology, especially as it applies to the care of our own patients. In reality, this is a nearly impossible task for individual practitioners, and we all need to rely in part on clinical practice guidelines to guide our practice, even for recommendations that are based on expert consensus, because it's likely that these recommendations are better informed than our, quote, own, end of quote, expert opinion in many of these cases.
Dr. Newman, I want to turn to your editorial that also appears in the July 2021 issue of the journal. The editorial is titled, Clinical Practice Guidelines in Anesthesiology, Adjusting Our Expectations. You do a terrific job of putting Dr. Glantz's article into perspective. I want to start by quoting the first three lines of your editorial. Clinical practice guidelines are statements that include recommendations intended to optimize patient care based on a systematic review of evidence and an assessment of the benefits and costs of alternative care options. They're valued resources for practitioners, especially in anesthesiology, where providers often work in relative isolation from their peers. And surveys of American Society of Anesthesiology members have repeatedly ranked ASA practice parameters as a top benefit of membership. Despite the noble aim behind creating clinical practice guidelines and their value to practitioners, Dr. Glantz has found that they're often based on nothing more than expert opinion. Isn't that surprising?
Thank you, Dr. Rathmel. You know, we thought this was a great article and really worth attention and focus. as Dr. Glantz said, in a lot of ways, this isn't that surprising. We've seen publications from the cardiology community for now over 10 years that have shown that many clinical practice guideline recommendations are based on opinion or lower level forms of evidence. You know, the nature of medical research is that questions that come up in clinical practice are not always immediately addressed through high-quality randomized trials in real time, and it takes time for evidence to develop. And there are challenges in developing that, even for practices that have been around for a long time. So in the broader context, it's not surprising, although it's really important that this sheds light on our specific context of anesthesia and perioperative care.
So no, it's not surprising at all that they're based on low levels of evidence. How do you think clinicians should use existing guidelines in a meaningful way?
Well, you know, we titled our editorial Adjusting Our Expectations. And I think the perspective that I came from and that my co-author, Jeff Applebaum, developed with me was that, you know, the safest way to view clinical practice guidelines, even those that have substantial numbers of recommendations that are based on trials, are as well-intentioned but necessarily imperfect human products. They should be seen as one of several potential inputs to any decision incorporating clinicians' own experience, the patient's needs and preferences, and the potential uncertainty of the evidence underlying the guideline. What clinicians do in practice every day is they balance these different inputs in their own decisions. I think the more clinicians know about the types of evidence that go into guidelines, they can make more informed choices about how to use or modify or go away from recommendations they find based on individual patient needs in the context.
I like that. Imperfect human products. So how can we develop more meaningful guidelines? And is there any approach we can take while we await robust clinical trials in some of these areas?
Yeah, I think that a big part of developing more meaningful guidelines is kind of acknowledging and accepting the uncertainty that comes with the research that underlies them, even when that research might be randomized trials. There certainly have been episodes of evidence reversal, even involving things that initially look good in trials. You know, scenarios where practices that seem really promising in early work, even rigorously conducted, end up not being able to be validated or replicated in subsequent work. I think guidelines in general, not just in anesthesiology, can improve themselves by kind of accepting that this is part of the process of medical research and taking ownership of that and following it up and studying those episodes where certain recommendations turned out to get reversed or be incorrect over time. Another thing that guidelines and the organizations that produce them can do is to look into the reasons why guidelines are versus aren't adhered to. We know there are big issues with adherence to guidelines. Understanding those specific recommendations and guidelines that are successful in transforming practice and impacting care versus those that aren't, I think can help give us better insights as to how to make guidelines that are going to be really effective at the end of the day in improving care and improving outcomes.
You bring in the idea of refraining from making recommendations in some of these areas. Can you give us an example where that might be wise?
Yeah, I'll offer a couple of examples. And the reason that, you know, there are a few reasons why we suggest that it might be wise to refrain. You know, a couple of big reasons here is that there's a potential for guidelines to unintentionally interfere with subsequent research. If there's an area that's understudied and a guideline comes out and makes a recommendation, it can make it harder to actually do a trial. Another reason is that it may just be wasteful. If a guideline pushes care in one direction and there's subsequent research that finds something else, you've invested effort to change practice in a way that may not necessarily have been the best choice. Two examples I can offer about places where guideline makers might wish to, you know, put some thought before proceeding with making recommendations. One is where large trials are already in progress. If you have a guideline development process that happens to overlap with a period where a trial is ongoing and you know that you're going to have results, coming out and putting out a guideline statement that's just going to have to get revised in the next couple of years based on trial results that are anticipated may not be the most efficient strategy and may just cause confusion when it comes to trying to interpret and disseminate the results of the eventual trial. Another space where it might be worth considering refraining, and this is maybe a little more controversial, I would argue would be in areas of practice where there are high degrees of variability that's long-standing. If you have a type of practice that's out in the world where a big portion of the anesthesiologist community is doing one thing and another big portion is doing another for a long time, that can be taken to signal disagreement about what the best choices are, a state of, you know, clinical equipoise. In that context, you know, if trials can be done to resolve that, that's the best strategy. Going ahead and trying to resolve those uncertainties by making statements and guidelines is a lot less effective. And so in those cases, instead of coming up with recommendations, suggesting what kinds of trials and starting to act to make them a possibility might in the long run be better for patient care.
Now, you addressed my next question already when you told us that guideline-producing organizations should look carefully at guidelines they produce that aren't adhered to as they go forward. What else should guideline-producing organizations like the ASA do differently?
Well, you know, as Dr. Glantz mentioned in his comments, what the ultimate decider of the quality of guidelines is going to be is what the clinical trial evidence base looks like. And to that end, funding trials, investing in infrastructures to support trials, funding early stage investigators who can propose big, ambitious trials, those are important things. Another really important thing that big organizations can do is to communicate to practicing physicians that participating in research, especially comparative effectiveness research around commonly used therapies, is something that they can do to actually make the specialty stronger, better, and more evidence-based over time. To get big trials done, you need buy-in from practicing clinicians at the front line who are delivering treatments. I think the more we make being part of research something that we communicate to our specialties, something that's good for our field, I think the further we'll get in trying to produce better evidence.
Absolutely. There's nothing like being on the front line and actually trying to recruit patients at the same time you're trying to move forward quickly with the course of an intraoperative day. So, Dr. Glantz, you get the last word today. Is there anything more you'd like to add? And I'd like to have you tell us what comes next for you and your research group.
Jim, thanks so much for the opportunity to discuss our work. And I just want to kind of reiterate the main takeaway point is that we need more and higher quality evidence on which to base our practice, not only in anesthesia, but in medicine in general. But I think we need to recalibrate. Randomized controlled trials are extraordinarily expensive. And I think over time, what we need to see is more high quality evidence that is based on observational study. The expectation that every causal question can be studied with a randomized controlled trial is frankly unrealistic. Now, there's always a concern that inferences based on observational studies will be misrepresented as causation. However, the results of observational studies have often been shown to be consistent with the findings of randomized controlled trials. In fact, it's been shown in most cases. A recent Cochrane systematic review back in 2014 comparing randomized controlled trials to observational trials found, quote, little evidence for a significant effect difference between observational studies and randomized controlled trials. So rigorous analyses of the impact of medical interventions can be evaluated using robust econometric approaches, for example, difference-in-difference analysis, to make causal inferences. This is not association. These are causal inferences. So, for example, if you wanted to assess the impact of a quantitative twitch monitoring by comparing, say, an outcome, the incidence of reintubations in a hospital before and after the adoption of this technique, you could compare the changes in the hospitals which did this pre and post to a comparable group of hospitals over the same time period that did not institute quantitative twitch monitoring. So the idea is that well-conducted observational studies could be used to, quote, fill in many of the holes in the evidence that we need to advance the science of perioperative medicine and anesthesiology. So the key really is going to be to continue our efforts to strengthen our clinical data infrastructure. We need better data, higher quality data. We also need to invest more in educating the next generation of physician scientists. In particular, we need to have more people with expertise in computer science, statistical learning, and machine learning so that we can transform our hospitals and operating rooms into true learning healthcare systems.
Terrific. I hope today's discussion will lead many of you listening to read this new article that appears in the July 2021 issue of Anesthesiology, where you can learn more about clinical practice guidelines in anesthesiology and their current limitations. Dr. John Wanderer from Vanderbilt and I also created an infographic that appears in the same issue, and it's titled Anesthesia Clinical Practice Guidelines, A View Through the Kaleidoscope, where we highlight the primary findings of these articles. Doctors Glantz, Lacerna, and Newman, thank you for joining me today and for the terrific explanations.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Anesthesiology Journal Podcast, the official peer-reviewed journal of the American Society of Anesthesiologists. Check anesthesiology.org for an archive of this podcast and other related content.